as is, we have many Mexican food just because the country is so, so big and we do have so many different like subcultures. But on the dangerous part of it, I would think it's like New York have similarities that food you find on the streets and you can eat on the streets and it's amazingly delicious.
Hello, this is Harry Honk and this is Talking About Everything. And I'm back again with Nicholas Gilman. Nicholas, where are we?
We are in a restaurant called Paprika, which is located in the Colonia Juarez, a.k.a. the Zona Rosa, in the center of Mexico City.
Who are we going to speak to today?
We are going to meet with one of my favorite chefs in Mexico City, Josefina Santa Cruz.
And what is she famous for? Is she famous for Mexican food, I'm guessing?
What's interesting is she's a proponent of Mexican food. She is practically an activist, and yet her restaurants, two of them, are not about Mexican food at all. They're about Asian food and North African food.
Wow. Well, I'm excited. I'm looking forward to meeting her in a moment.
So we're in Paprika, which is a small, really casual, very pretty little restaurant that features North African and Israeli and all kinds of food from that part of the world. Your other restaurant is Sesame, which features where you serve Asian street food. How did you get into that? You're a Mexican chef in Mexico. What's going on here?
Well, first of all, hi. I think I got into it because when I was a kid, many years ago, I don't know, but when I was, I mean, Mexico used to be a city with a lot of restaurants, but most of them were either just like tacos, Mexican places, and the high-end places were French, Italian, and Spanish. And whatever we had on Asian food, I remember it was a place called Mauna Loa, which I always thought it was just like Asian, and it was like Polynesian. And the only thing I liked to go for at Mauna Loa was because it was like the tiki room.
I remember that place. It was terrible.
It was horrible. It was like the tiki room in Disneyland. But the only thing I liked is that they would give you the drinks with a little umbrella or stuff. But I thought the food was always too sweet and sour and too sweet. So in my mind, Asian food was yucky. For many years, I think it was like that. Then I met sushi, and I fell in love with sushi. Mm. But then when I went to New York to study, I had a friend. He was from San Francisco, and he was a former cop. And you know what they say, no? Cops always end up at the Chinese joints. And
they end up at the best joints, too.
Exactly. Small joints, whatever, but the best. So he invited me for Chinese, and I was like, oh, please, no. And he said, no, come. I can't believe you don't like it. And I think that was my first introduction to, like, real Chinese yummy flavors. And it was, like, eye-opening. And I fell in love with discovering and realizing how mistaken I was.
Let me ask, where did you study in New York?
I at the CIA in Hyde Park.
Yep. Excellent.
And I want to say that this is evidence of the fact that Mexico City is an international city. We of course, promote and love Mexican food, but we are really expanding our horizons here. Mexico City, it's a world-class city, and we have so many more options now. I think the palates of Mexicans are opening up. But you are also a real promoter of Mexican food and Mexican street food as well. So how do those two things coincide?
I think I'm in love with street food, generally speaking. And I think that part of what I like about Asian food is that I think the best Asian food is found in the streets. I think that's where Mexico and Asia and probably also part of the Middle Eastern and all this like spice root thing that I do in Paprika have similarities that food you find on the streets and you can eat on the streets and it's amazingly delicious.
Can I ask, is there something like the night market, the Asian night market here culturally or?
No, we have in Coyoacán, no? There's in Coyoacán, there's a Mercado de Antojitos, which is a small market. It's not open all night, but well, it does open until probably 10 or 12, I think. And yes, so you find the quesadilla stand and then the guy that makes the pozole and the other one that makes the best tostadas de pata and stuff like that. And see, that is a small market where all they sell is like prepared like food and street food.
But there is food going on all night. Mm-hmm. And there are taquerias, small joints that are open all night. And there are street stands that are open all night. They're not a night market as such the way they are in Asia, but I wish there was. but there's always food on the street here.
I mentioned it because someone in New York just tried doing it, and they did a Kickstarter. They didn't quite make all the money they needed, but they did it anyway. The first night, 10,000 people showed up, and it's been phenomenal. John Wong, if I got your name right, John. But it's just a very interesting business development and food and people.
Wow. And is that only Asian food or no? It's
no.
All kinds of street food.
But it happens to be in Flushing at the Queens Museum. And so it's a lot of Asian, but not my good friend. We have an episode, Carl Palma and his takoyaki, which is the octopus balls, but his place called Carl's Balls. But I mean, there's so many, so many great, exactly. That's, he wants to laugh. But it's just so great. And people are just waiting and talking and the sun has gone down. But I love that you're talking about that this is not only an international city, but it's a 24 hours worth of eating city.
Yes. I think when I lived in New York, I worked there for 5 years. I think one of the things that I missed the most was the variety, because granted, in Manhattan, you can find pizza, but it's the greasy slice of pizza, which usually at 3 a.m. is amazingly delicious, or hot dogs maybe, or maybe the falafel guys, but that's about it. And in Mexico, it's like you will never, if you're hungry at whatever time of the day, you will find a corner with something to eat and something delicious and cheap, which is also great. I think in Mexico, you could eat out on the street every day. And in fact, we have, I think also like in Asia, we have like different menus kind of like for breakfast and for lunch and for all day and for the nighttime. And I think that's one of the things that I fell in love with Asian food and Mexican, that I just started realizing how similar we are in a way, how different, but how similar. And also the flavor, how do you call this? Like the profiles are very similar too, because I love French food, but I think French food is like, okay, one or two layers of flavor, and your filet with whatever green peppercorn sauce is going to be amazing from beginning to end, but it's going to be the same flavor all the time. Whereas Mexican food and Asian food play with your mouth a little bit more, no?
Absolutely. And we have so many ingredients that we sent to Asia. Chilies are the most obvious and the very first. And then and spices and fruits and vegetables that came back from Asia, from especially Southeast Asia and India. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of India and Thailand. They're making these sauces and these curries that are kind of an alchemy, the way our moles and salsas are here, but the flavors are very different.
Exactly. And I think it's amazing that, to me, a curry is a mole and a mole is a curry at the end of the day, because it is, I mean, mole means like ground. And it's also, you will never find a mole with only two ingredients or a curry with only two ingredients. And that is what makes, I think, both sauces amazing, because it's 10, 15 ingredients. And when you think about it, we might be using, like Nicholas was saying, we might be using the same ingredients, just that in different proportions. So then the outcome is completely different.
And also the mole and a curry and a masala in India is about the sauce. It's not about the chicken or whatever it is that's in the sauce. And that's the same way we think of moles here. People will have a plate of mole and there's a little, you know, scrawny chicken leg in there, and they'll go like, where's the meat? And you have to explain to them that the dish is the sauce, exactly. Is the mole. The chicken's just sort of
And that's very Asian, the sense that the meat is flavor, but it's not the meal.
That's where it's different from European or a French approach to cooking.
And I think it's also part of what I like is we eat like the same way. You eat with your hands. We use a tortilla, they use the naan or the whatever other bread they have. And it's part of like soaking the bread yes. In the sauce. That's the yummy part of it. And we also serve it usually with rice. We do it rice and beans, they do it rice and dal. It's very similar. And we also have, that I found really interesting, how moles, the regular mole would be more like a curry, but then our green mole is more like a Thai curry. Because it's done with fresh ingredients. So we do have both, like the mole done with all fresh ingredients, and then we have the mole done with dry spices and chilies and also the thickening agents. And so it's very similar. We eat it like the same way, and it's not about the plating it. It's not a beautiful plating. It's more about how you just like end up mixing everything together and just enjoying the sauce.
And the thing is, for those of us who grew up in the United States or in certain European countries where we are used to having a real diversity of ethnic cuisine, Mexicans aren't and don't. And even people who are fairly young didn't have anything like that available. And all of a sudden you are presenting dishes from all over the world in very traditional ways. You're not really messing with them, are you? You're trying to sort of reproduce them as best we can. What's been the reaction with the public?
I do the best I can. I don't mean to be creative about it. I'm not inventing anything because I think that would be very presumptuous.
Cultural appropriation.
Yes. I mean, not, what am I going to teach the Chinese, no? I think to me, what started giving me this, like, I want to do something different, was that I had that opportunity in New York of eating in so many different places. And then I had the opportunity of traveling. And then I would come back to Mexico and say, so we only have the pizza, the taco, and the Spanish, French, and the expensive high-end Chinese Cantonese, which was also like, why is it expensive? When in New York, half of the students eat Chinese takeout, and that's what they eat every night. And here in Mexico, we had all these like super nice, very pretentious, very high-end, and very expensive Chinese restaurants. And it was Asian food.
Rather mediocre, too.
And rather mediocre. But then it was as if Asian food was Chinese, and that was the end of Asia. And when I discovered in New York, I had the Vietnamese and Thai and this, I'm like, there's all these other amazing flavors that in Mexico, I'm sure we're going to like just because we have this, the spicy, but the tangy, but the sweet, but we like and we are very familiar with. And I thought, okay, we need to, or I want to kind of like be able to share that with people and open our minds to it.
I probably used the word wrong, but a simpatico. When I think of Vietnamese food, I think of cooked ingredients, but also raw ingredients. And I also think of the same with Mexican. And maybe a very fresh salsa, but there may be some vegetables, a pico de gallo. Am I right that there is some cultural affinity for cooked and fresh ingredients together?
I think that there is. Sometimes you cook something and then you add something fresh at the end. Or then, like you were saying, we have sauces that are like completely raw, completely roasted, completely, and it just gives a different depth and the flavor if you make the same exact sauce raw or roasted or boiled. So we play around in that sense.
There's the joke that the Chinese will eat anything that's going to be cooked, but don't give them a green salad. Now, that's changed today, of course. But
Mexicans, too, I think it's changed lately, like you were saying, also in Mexico. But I think we were not very much into the salad part of it. Also because we had very boring lettuces in Mexico until recently. Mm-hmm. What Nicholas was saying is, I mean, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, when I came back from the CIA, I remember going to the market and trying to buy arugula, and they didn't even know what that was. Or even rosemary. I would buy rosemary, and I would ask for rosemary, and the guy would send me with the brujo, the guy that sells all the herbs for the cleaning of the bad spirits and whatever, and I would go and say, I want rosemary, and the guy would, what are you going to use it for?
Yeah, because nobody ate any of these things. They have arugula grows by the side of the road here, but they feed it to the pigs. It's a totally new kind of flavor. And now we can find it in some of our local street markets. It's not in the most in small villages or anything, but in at least in urban markets, it's kind of become a normal thing. It's amazing.
I love this part of the conversation where we're talking about this food and culture and transformation.
I remember trying to buy basil, and the basil you would find was the tiny one with all the flowers already blooming because they use it to clean the bad vibes. So trying to make a nice pesto or anything with basil was like almost impossible 20, 25 years ago. So I think that this globalization and all this, I think it's been like super fast, no? Don't you think, Nicholas?
Yes.
I think in the past 10, 15 years with the opening of the markets and all this, I mean, it's a bunch of things that have affected, but I think we have more ingredients. Some of them still, I think Mexicans are still not very familiar. I mean, you see them in the supermarket, like cremini mushrooms, and half of the time people don't buy them because they don't even know how to cook them because they're new to us. But I think there's been a change in a very positive way.
And I think in higher end restaurants, which are places that elite people go, obviously they're introducing all kinds of dishes and all kinds of ways of cooking in Mexican food, what we call modern Mexican. And I think that's a good thing because I think it's going to trickle down. I think a cuisine that is stagnant, that doesn't grow and change, is just going to die. It always changes. We, of course, want to preserve traditional Mexican ways of cooking. And now there are these new sort of hip restaurants that are reviving all kinds of recipes from the past instead of just simply trying to make something new and trying to fuse cuisines, which often doesn't work, because how can you fuse a cuisine if you don't know both of the cuisine?
And I think that most of the time that fusion is more confusion. It's like you were saying, and some people are like, oh, so your place has a little bit of Mexican. I'm like, no, because I would have had to lived in China for a very long time. I would have had to really know the cuisine to the bone, and I would have to know Mexican cuisine to the bone in order to create a great fusion dish.
So to me, there's very few great fusions, and I'll mention one that we were talking earlier about, but Zach Palacio created a restaurant called Fatty Crab and then Fatty Q. My friend Robbie Richter, a competition barbecue guy, we've had him on the podcast, 125 barbecue awards or more, he did this competition barbecue, and then Zach took all these Malaysian flavors with a smoky meat. And so it worked, because those sauces and flavors is what you needed, because the meat's too rich, too much flavor. Together, they're just awesome. He's now moved on to other things with the Hudson Fish and Game. But I love pulling that together. So, I mean, what is your approach? I guess we should talk about a little what you, not what you didn't do, but what you did do.
What Nicholas was saying is important on Mexican food. And I'm that generation where, to me, it's very hard to fool around with Mexican food, just because I grew up in an era where Mexican food was a traditional Mexican food. So for me, I feel like weird, but I love what the new generations are doing. I think there's a couple of the chefs, I mean, Pablo Salas, and there are a lot of them that are doing amazing modern Mexican. When you eat it, you still know you're biting into Mexico. In a taco with maybe chorizo and sea urchin. And maybe 10 years ago was like, what? That's not Mexican, because sea urchin, blah, blah, because we didn't even know sea urchin, even though we do have it and whatever, and it's another. But I think that's great, and I think we needed that. We needed that sort of like breakthrough into trying and really having the guts or whatever to fool around with some of our traditional Mexican. So I think that's amazing. I don't want to do traditional Asian or traditional, and I don't intend to, because I don't have probably that much of a knowledge. And because I don't think I need to fool around with them. I don't think I'm going to do anything new to it or to make it better. So what I'm trying to do is just bringing those flavors. And that's why sesame is more like Asian, generally speaking, because I don't want anyone to say, this is not Chinese. I don't want them to come and ask for a sweet and sour chicken, sweet and sour pork, something in oyster sauce. No. What I want is sort of like to showcase the flavors and the profiles so people understand that Vietnamese is not Chinese, and it has absolutely nothing to do with, and the flavors are completely different. It's a lot more sophisticated, maybe in a way, or fresh or simple, and they're all different. And then in paprika, it's also the same thing. And we have so many of the ingredients. Someone asked me one time, is like, oh my God, and where do you get the spices? I'm like, here.
Here in Mexico.
Right in the market, and they're the same spices that they use there. They've always used them. They use a lot of the same spices to make moles, to make salsas.
When you think about it, we have, maybe they're not spices that are native to Mexico, as chili is not native maybe to China, but they've been there so many years that they're native now. So they're native. So cumin, to me, cumin is, we use cumin, not in the same proportion as Indians, but we use cumin, and a lot of places in Mexico use cumin, and a lot of dishes use cumin, and cilantro, the coriander seed, and star anise. And so I think spice-wise, we use a lot of the same spices. And in Middle Eastern food, or in what I call the spice route, no, in Syria and all these places, I think we also have a lot of flavor profiles that are very similar. When I was in Morocco and I had one of these tagines that has prunes and the dry apricots, I'm thinking that this is, in Mexico, we also do a lot of sauces, the sweet salty kind of thing, or sweet savory, more not salty, but savory. And that's amazing, no, that we also use dry fruits in our sauces as much as they use.
One of my clients has a Scandinavian bakery. And what was really interesting when I got involved with that was that all the spice root trade spices came to Scandinavia very early. And so everything that I would think in Asia that they would use in a savory dish, they use in sweets. So we got cardamom in the cookie. We have pepper in a cookie.
Yeah.
Is there anything here?
I think here is the other way around. Like cinnamon, you usually use in sweets. And then now, like, I use it here and people are like, oh my God, the Bastilla, no? It has the cinnamon
chocolate
on the top. It's like, because, exactly, because in our mind is more into the sweet side, but then you can also use it in the savory, like India or like in the Middle East. Or pepper, I was talking to someone the other day, the very first time I had pepper in a sweet dish wasn't 10 years ago when all the chefs started doing all this, just like the chocolate and salt and olive oil, blah, blah, discoveries. No, this was in Zanzibar in 1990. And I was there with a friend that studied Swahili or whatever. And they would give us a porridge. It was a drink and it was with pepper and sugar, with black pepper. To me, that was like, oh my God, black pepper and sugar. And that was 25 years ago in Africa.
I'm going to probably say this wrong, but Anatoly Champorado.
Ah, el atole and the champurrado.
Which is, a rice drink with what I'm thinking I've had in New York. It's Oaxaquino.
Traditional atole is made with corn, with dried and ground corn. But there are variations that are made with rice and with corn starch, but they're usually sweet.
Are you playing with any of these kinds of things?
No. As much as I'm not adapting or I'm not trying to do any fusion or something, it takes a little bit of time for people to be open to certain things because in their mind in Mexico would be atole. That's for the peasant. I mean, atole, you're not going to drink atole in a nice, cool restaurant in La Roma. That's sort of like something you eat with tamales in the morning at 5 in the morning. So you have to introduce sort of slow. Slowly, once people kind of trust you a little bit, they stay more on what you're doing. They still, some things are in their mind frame of Mexicans is still like, why would I have that?
So let's talk about adjusting. I think this is a question really for both of you. And I'm going to be speaking to my American friends when they say that they don't want to come to Mexico because they're thinking of the border towns, Tijuana, and the violence, and they're thinking of Cancun. I'm looking forward to being able to say, in all seriousness and with all humility, you're being racist, you're being limited, you're being xenophobic. That's not Mexico City in the same way that Cheyenne, Wyoming is not New York.
Well, that's true. I think you can't totally blame them because the media really focuses on those things. And people just think of Mexico as one big same place where everything's terrible. And you can see it's a huge country.
Yeah. And Nick, you're from New York. Josefina, you spent time in New York. Yes. So for somebody who's either from New York or knows of New York, right, someone who's probably an American, but why should they come to Mexico City if all the conversation we've just had hadn't really convinced anyone, which it should have, right? All this wonderful talk of food. What can you say?
It's a beautiful, very European city. There's a lot of tradition here. It's not like an American city because it goes back 500 years and beyond. In every way, visually, there's architecture. There's just a feeling of tradition and culture here that I don't think we have in American cities because they're not as old.
And I think, I mean, to begin with, it's like when you talk about Mexican food, is Mexican food, which Mexican food? Because as is, we have many Mexican food just because the country is so big and we do have so many different like subcultures, maybe, no, depending on the area. So the food is very different on each part of Mexico. But on the dangerous part of it, I would think it's like the very first time I went to New York. It was at the time of, I think it was like in 80-something. And I remember the subway being with all the graffiti. And it was in the time of the Warriors come out and play and all this. And it was horrible and terrible. But you would not be able to generalize that. And so I think, of course, there are dangerous areas in the city. Just like if you go to New York and, you know, maybe 12 o'clock at night, you don't want to be in
the middle of Central Park.
In that sense, I think, and like Nicholas say, I don't blame them. I think it's media, and I think it's media, international media, and it's our own media also that focuses sometimes on that. But Mexico City, I think, like Nicholas says, you have all this feeling of 500 years, but then you have other areas that are modern and have great feeling of, I mean, La Condesa has, you can walk around and you can feel like you're maybe somewhere in New York, that you have all these neighborhood bars and neighborhood places and the bakery and the coffee shop and the this and the that, and a lot of green, which I think Mexico City, as much as we could have a lot more, but there's areas with a lot of green and you can walk in the parks and all this like street food. To me, something that I always like in Mexico is that you have this kind of combination, how we can relate and be happy together with a street food stall, but then the other super high-end restaurant right around the corner. And it's a very democratic, in a way, I think, feeling to the... Exactly. I think that's something that, to me, when I went to New York, it was kind of like you have a little bit of everything. You just cross the street and it's completely different.
And now with our food trucks, it's even more so. And
yeah. And I think we have art. You know, we have great museums. If you're into museums, we have great museums. I mean, all this, the murals. And then you have just like green areas and you have great restaurants. And you have San Angel, which is a cobblestone, more Spanish feeling. So I think Mexico City has a lot to offer for any taste. No, I think of whatever kind of traveler you are or visitor you are, I think we have a little bit of everything.
So let me ask a very different question, which would be if someone's listening, they are from Mexico or their family's from Mexico, and maybe some of the things you've been talking about, they are also coming from your own perspective of the very traditional sense of Mexican food made by the mother, the grandmother, the aunt, and shouldn't be changed. I have students who have Mexican heritage. What would you say to them about playing with their food?
I think we have to be open to playing with it. We just have to be careful and respectful of. I think that the important thing is what I would do is if I played around with it, and I did when I was in New York for a while in Pompano, we did play around with it. But I didn't play with it as much as the guys are doing right now. But I think it's do something, close your eyes, bite into it. If it tastes like Mexico, then it's fine. And it doesn't have to be, because Mexican food, let's say on the plating, we're not very, I mean, just traditional Mexican food is bold. It's just boom, go like that. But you can, and you can just make it a little bit more stylish just on the plating and maybe some of the flavors more subtle. I think just play with it and be honest about your own criticism. I had an instructor at the CIA that I love to death, and he used to say, guys, whatever, be creative. Please be creative. Just don't get fucking creative. I just think you have to be creative. You have to play, and sometimes it'll go fine, and sometimes it's going to be horrible. Just be honest about it and try it again.
And there's nothing wrong with bringing a little bit of contemporary global approach to cooking and presentation and context, because a lot of it is just context. And as you say, you might close your eyes. You go to a place like Dulce Patria, where everything is very fancy and everything is beautifully presented, but it's still mole, and you close your eyes and it's a really good mole negro with duck. So she presents it differently, and she's getting these ideas from Europe, from Spain, but the flavors are there, and that's, as you say, that's what's important, to respect tradition, to not to turn your back on it.
You say in English, if it's not broken, why fix it? I mean, the flavors in Mexican food are there. What I think in Mexico we need to do is start looking more into our food and stop trying to make our food look like Copenhagen, say whatever they're doing. Noma or anything like that. I think we can take some of the techniques, we can think about it, but at the end of the day, I'm sure René Redzepi would love to be in Mexico and cook with 110 ingredients, more than the 5 ingredients he has over there. But if you want to fool around with it and play with it and maybe make the foam of, I'm not into that kind of cooking because I don't know how to do it, but I respect people that do it and know how to do it. You can make a taco and maybe the little foam will be an habanero foam. And if it's well executed and whatever, and you bite into the taco, and instead of an habanero sauce, you have an habanero foam or an habanero sphere or one of those funky things, but it tastes like it should taste, go for it. I think it's amazing.
And the other thing we've talked about before is the amazing ingredients that we have from all over the country, from the coasts, from the forests, from high, from low. We really have amazing products. And I think that's something that's really starting to really happening here, where chefs and cooks are taking advantage of what's local, what's great, what's amazing from Mexico.
You can look at all these like the quelites. Now they're so like in. Quelites are just herbs, wild greens that for a long time, in Mexico we have been, or for a long time we were very, I don't know how you say it, malinchistas, where everything that came from the outside was better than whatever we had.
Cultural colonialism.
Exactly. So something fancy had to be European. So you would never, ever think of serving an important person a tamal, you know, at home, because that would be like for the peasants, and you would have them for dinner maybe, or for supper, but that's not something you would serve.
Or even ingredients within a tamal, like these quelites that you're talking about. That's like what the poor people eat. That's what the maid eats. Why would I serve that to my fancy guests? And of course, now we're starting to realize how amazing and wonderful these mm-hmm. things are.
And I think we're starting to recognize them and starting to give them a place at all these like restaurants with this white tablecloth and blah, 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 and serving things that were supposed to be for the peasants before, but they're great. And I don't criticize that. I just think it's great because there's a lot of Mexican people that didn't even know. So now they think it's an exotic herb. No, it's not exotic. I mean, you find it, like Nicola said, it's like it would grow anywhere, and it's just amazing.
I'm just a strong believer in strong flavors, and I love that there shouldn't be this divide between, quote, peasant and everybody else, that we're all people, and we should all have food that's local to us and have an approach to it. And we shouldn't have some kind of connotation that I'm elitist and I should have this better food. If we aren't of the belief that we should all have good food, then there's something wrong with this world. But when you were talking before about cooking techniques and stuff, and I think, you know, one of the things that clearly Mexican food has is the slow braising, slow cooking techniques. And I think maybe not so much some of the quicker grilling kinds of things, but then I'm wondering, has sous vide found a way in? Because that's almost similar.
Yes, it's found a way in a lot of restaurants, of Mexican restaurants. I still think I like it more like the old way, but I do understand that you're in a restaurant and you need to serve things fast and whatever, but it has. Because to begin with, I think there's a misconception on Mexican food that Mexican food makes you fat. And I always say, or is fattening. No, I get fat because I, instead of having just two gorditas de chicharrón, I'll have four. And maybe nowadays people will drink it with a soda instead of with water. But I think traditional Mexican cooking techniques are really healthy because it's a lot of steamed stuff, a lot of slow cooked in its own juice. I mean, a barbacoa or anything like that is just steamed in its own juice. And it's just like cooked for a long time. And if I'm going to have fat, I'd rather have fat from the real thing or just any other those substitutes to that. Low fat, low this, low that. Yeah, but then you have to add shantan this or shantan whatever kind of like chemicals. But it has. Sous vide is in Mexico. It has, I think, in a lot of the restaurants for all those low cooking ingredients.
But I think it's a good way, in a sense, perhaps to really slow cook something, obviously, but still, you still can have a rare or medium kind of texture to the meat.
But meanwhile, there are traditional dishes like barbacoa that are cooked for hours and hours in a pit, wrapped in leaves or coals. I mean, there are traditional ways of preparing meat because you, remember, we've talked about this before, how here we use the whole animal. We do not waste anything, and whole animals are cooked. We eat from the feet to the head. I think we said this before. And you have to cook it slow and long to be able to eat a head. You can't put a head in a pot and have it ready in 20 minutes.
No. And I think the flavor does change. I think a lot of the restaurants are using sous vide, and I think it's amazing. But there are certain flavors that you will never, ever, just like barbecue and the grill. I mean, you might want to do it, I don't know, maybe in the sous vide, and then just at the end, put it on the grill. And the flavor is not going to be there because the smokiness and depending on the wood that you're using at the pit and whatever.
Or the clay pot. Mm-hmm. The beautiful ollas and cazuelas that we use that are still for sale in the market, made by hand, because there's nothing that can replace them. You know, no metal pot, no Le Creuset is going to replace a fantastic cazuela. And every housewife and top-end chef knows this.
But it is. It's. I mean, a lot of these like new techniques are being used in a lot of the restaurants.
I think we've had a good conversation here, and I don't want to impose too much on your time. But I would ask you to, both of you, Nicholas and Josefina, to say really anything, a question that I haven't asked or something that's been in the back of your mind that you wanted to talk about?
No, I think now that when you mentioned the you didn't want to sound like elitist or whatever on the food, I totally agree with you. And that's, I think all restaurants I've had or whatever, that's what I've tried to, is like, good food should be available to anybody. And I think street food, in my mind, is one of those things that I love because it's great food, it's good, it talks about the culture of a country or whatever, but it's also very democratic. I mean, I love to see it in Mexico that you go and you might see the guy with a suit that just got off of a car with a whatever driver and this and that. And right next to him is going to be a construction worker having the exact same thing. I'm Josefina Santa Cruz in Mexico City, and I'm a chef at Sesame Asian Street Food at Colonia Roma and Paprika Spice Root Cuisine in Colonia Juarez. And you can find me at Josefi Santa Cruz on Instagram and Josefi Santa Cruz on Twitter, and the restaurants at Sesame MX and Paprika _DF.
And you can read my review at goodfoodmexicocity.com. www.goodfoodmexicocity.com.
My name is Harry Hawk, and you have been listening to a wonderful conversation about food and culture. I hope that everybody has a great day. You can find me on Twitter at HHAWK, and you can find this podcast and many others at talkingabouteverything.com. Again, I hope you have a great week. Bye-bye.
My name is Chuck Fresh, and I am being paid to thank you for listening to Talking About Everything with Harry Hawk. Harry wants to hear from you on Twitter at HHawk or HarryHawk@gmail.com. And now, a word from our sponsor, Life Extension Coach and favorite chef. Hawk Digital Marketing is focused on bringing brands and people together. We build communities of interest based on trust and transparency, where consumers and brands can converse, learn, discuss, or solve problems together, while creating a long-term connection, entanglement, between you and your customers. Once connected, we help you engage, communicate, sell, present, educate, and inform. Evolve your communications with us. HawkSocialMarketing.com.